My name is Joe Valdez. I'm grateful to be a recovering alcoholic. I want you to know that all my meetings are represented here tonight. My men's meeting on Wednesday night, my Friday night meeting, my Saturday morning meeting, and a couple of my Sunday morning and Sunday evening meetings. So, you know, I have to tell the truth. Plus, I have my wife here. I need to tell you that what I say here is strictly my opinion and my opinion only, you know, and that what I want to tell you has been my experience as I learned it through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, so you might hear some stuff that, like, don't get involved in the first 12 months of recovery, that I used the big book on my sponsor for with that one, and some other stuff that is suggested by this program. That's why we say it's a suggested program. I like to believe that if it's not in the big book, then I might be able to try it. So having said that, that's why I say it's my opinion only, and listen to your sponsor. If you don't have a sponsor, you need to get a sponsor. I want to begin, but it's like my mind is just being bombarded with everything. Where's our 10-minute speaker? You are great, wherever you're at. There you are. Great. You know? Congratulations to the 8 years, to the 90 days. It's fantastic. We all had to have our first day and our first 90-day token in our first year to get to where we're at. My sobriety date is June 5th, 1981. And I don't say that to impress you. I say that because I still believe that I've had a short time in this program. You know, and I say that for the same reason that our 10-minute speaker said, is that all I have is today. You know, and it doesn't matter how many years I got. If I'm not living the program today, then I'm that much closer to a drink. As a matter of fact, if you want to know how close I am to a drink, that's it right there. Okay? An arm's length away. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I was raised in a migrant working family for the first 14 years of my life. My father drank. And he drank alcoholically after the 14 years as a migrant worker. But he drank nonetheless. But I got to see a lot of alcoholic drinking in migrant working camps as I was growing up. After my father started drinking on a regular basis and started becoming alcoholic, he was my role model. And I say that because he'd come home from work every day with 2 quarts of beer. He'd have a quart of beer before dinner. He'd have a quart of beer with dinner. He'd watch Gunsmoke, Paladin, or The Rifleman, and then he'd go to bed and go to sleep, and he'd wake up at 4 o'clock the next morning, go to work at 5, and repeat that every day until he retired. Until he retired. My father loved his beer, and he wanted to have his boys drink beer with him. And the only problem with that was that I didn't like beer. I didn't like the taste of beer. My older brother liked the taste of beer. So my older brother and my father had a little bit better relationship than I had with my father. And so that was one of my issues when I came into this program, is that I wanted to have a relationship with my dad where my dad hugged me and told me he loved me. But if you know anything about the Mexican culture, men are not trained and they're not raised to share their feelings and give hugs to each other and tell you, I love you. You know, just don't do that. You know, and so I grew up with me and my father not having a good relationship, being jealous of my brother having a great relationship with my father. And, you know, I didn't like the taste of beer. So I'll tell you one funny joke and I'll get on. My father wanted me to like the taste of beer. And so he'd give me, here's your half a can of beer. I don't want it. So he'd tell my brother, he'd say, go beat him up, and I'll give you his half a beer. So my brother would come up and, you know, yeah, poor me. Anyways, I was a chubby little Mexican, at least I like to believe that. But my brother, it got to the point where my brother used to come up and he'd hit me. I'd run into the kitchen. My mom would take care of me, and she'd, you know, heat up a tortilla and butter it for me, roll it up, and I'd sit there and eat and watch her cook. And my brother got to drink his full can of beer. deal for everybody, except that I kept on getting hit. You know? And so what I figured out, not too short, long after that, was that if I fell just as he was swinging, okay, he'd never hit me. So he came up, he tried to hit me, I'd fall down, start crying, he'd run, go get his beer, I'd run, get my tortilla. Nobody got hurt. It was a deal for me. You know? So that's how I got introduced to drinking, and those were my role models. You know? I'd forgotten about that. So my father drank, and he became alcoholic. He was a good provider all the way through his drinking. You know, working the migrant working fields, he was very successful at that. You know, so he was a determined man. He had good working ethics. He had good morals. My mom passed away when I was 16 years old of cancer, and she had been my role model for education, for wanting to move forward and succeed. You know, for all those things that she had, that she was role model for, and she was a lovely woman, beautiful woman. And when she died, all my motivation went away. I was 16 and a half, so a year and a half later when I was 18, I decided I was going to join the Marine Corps in my senior year of high school because I wanted to get away from my father's alcoholic drinking, because you can imagine that if she was the one that was controlling his drinking, his alcoholism just went rampant after that. And so I got out. I joined the Marine Corps. And so, having joined the largest dysfunctional family in the United States, you know, they too do not encourage you to hug each other and kiss each other and say, "What's the matter?" Doesn't work. And so, you know, I joined the Marine Corps, and I had, you know, up to that point, I'd only drank two times. And both times was a controlled environment, because I had to go home afterwards, and if I showed up drunk, my father would hit me and beat me up, basically, because what was I doing drinking and not giving him any, first of all? And the other thing is that I woke him up before he had to go to work. So I never got drunk because of the fear of going home to my dad. You know, well, being in the Marine Corps, I was on my own. I was a man. You know, I'd made it through boot camp. And so I drank, and I drank alcoholically from the very first time that I drank of my own free will. And I was up at San Clemente on the beach, and I drank till I blacked out. You know, I think six of us got together, and we got as much beer and alcohol as we could drink, or thought we could. And, you know, we passed out on the beach. And that was my introduction to how we drink in the Marine Corps. And I had other role models after that that showed me that that was the way it was supposed to be. Because in the Marine Corps in 1970, 71, 72, you know, that era, you know, it was drink and be happy before tomorrow you might be dead. That was our motto, you know. And we drank, and we partied hardy, and we did all those things that you do when you're drunk. Well, not exactly, because some people just go home. I didn't. I tended to black out and carry on for those guys that couldn't, you know. And so, you know, I'd be coming home at 3 o'clock in the morning, to reveille at 5 o'clock in the morning, to a run at 5:15, and, you know, throwing up as we're running. You know, but that was okay as long as you were in formation for the run. Because the work ethics that my father instilled in me and the work ethics that the Marine Corps wanted in me was that we don't care what you do the night before. As long as you're up in formation and you're out there either being part of the platoon or leading the platoon. And I many times was running with my sergeant, who was my squad leader, who was puking right along with me because we were both out the night before. You know, those were my role models. That's how I learned how to drink. You drink as much as you can because you don't know when the next time is going to be that you're going to be able to drink. And so I drank. And the Marine Corps taught me real well that if you're able to work and drink, you're going to be successful. You know, and I was. I was. I was selected for Gunnery Sergeant E7 when I had 7 years in the Marine Corps, 7.5 years in the Marine Corps. And back in the 70s, that's unheard of. Yeah, that was unheard of, you know, but I was a recruiter. I looked good. I had a little bit of less of this and a lot more of this because I was working every day, working out every day, running every day, you know, but I was drinking every night and I was going to parties every night and I was recruiting all these young men. I'd go into the high schools and I'd say, go after the football players, go after the wrestlers, you know, and Of course, I would always pick the good-looking high school senior girls and escort them to their classroom in my dress blue uniform. What young lady doesn't want to be escorted to her class by a Marine? Arr. Oh, yeah. And so this attracted the young man, and I was successful. I was, you know, I was recruited for the state of Wisconsin, you know, and they loved the fact that I was, you know, I was bilingual, still am, but I was bilingual. I used to go into the Mexican neighborhoods, Spanish-speaking neighborhoods, and I'd recruit all the Spanish-speaking folks because I'd be able to talk to their parents, not to the kids. I talked to the parents about getting them out of the bad neighborhoods, and yeah, boom, you're going in. I don't want to. I don't care. And they were gone. And but it was a time of peace at the time, between 75 and 80. No wars. Best time to go in the Marine Corps. That was my line was until Iran was overrun, and one of the young men that I put in the Marine Corps happened to be on embassy duty taking care of that embassy, and I got a call from his mother. Anyways, my drinking. Getting back to my drinking. My drinking escalated. I got drunk, blacked out the first time, went home. The father that I couldn't get along with, we had something in common. We both drank. It was middle of December when I went home on leave. And he said, let's go to the bar. So I went to the bar with him. That was the first time he ever invited me to go drinking with him. Went to the bar with him. We sat there. And he said, give me my Boilermaker and get my son the Marine, whatever he wants. That was it, man. I was home. I had recognition from my father. He didn't call me Raul. He said, the Marine. You know? And so that was it. For me, my identity from that point on was as a United States Marine. You know, because if that was going to get me my father's love and recognition, I wanted it. And so I drank with him. And, you know, we both got drunk. We both blacked out. And we both got home somehow. But we got home. You know? And my drinking continued to escalate. I got... In 1971, I got married at Cherry Point, North Carolina, because I was told I couldn't get married without permission first. Not that I'm defiant in any way, but I was going to show them that you could, and I did. And the reason why I got married was because my lieutenant said, you know, you need some responsibility in your life. You're getting drunk every night. You're coming in late. You're a damn good Marine. Don't want to see you get into any more trouble. Get married. Aye, aye. So I went and found myself a young lady. She agreed to marry me. She should have known there was a problem because she was engaged at the time. And I asked her out, and she said, I'm engaged. And I said, that's okay, bring him too. She did. And we met the next Friday, and we were together after that. I was drinking, because Marines drink beer out of pitchers. We don't drink out of glasses. We were drinking out of pitchers. And I was a dancing fool back then. And I was out there dancing on the floor. And she came in with her fiancé, and I asked her out to dance, and she did. And we were together after that. A year later, after we were married, I was tired of being married. I mean, I have to go report to the Marine Corps every day. Then I have to go report to my wife every night. You know, I can't go out drinking with the guys the way I used to, and I want to go out drinking with the guys the way I used to. And that's where my drinking took me, because this is a beautiful woman. She took really good care of me. But I didn't want that. I wanted what was out there. I don't know what it was that was out there, but I wanted whatever it was. You know, and so there was fights about drinking. You know, I wanted to go drink, or I'd come home drunk, and she'd ask me about if I'd been drinking. And of course not! You know, and we'd get into an argument, and boom. So I volunteered to go overseas. I went to Okinawa, Japan in 1972. When scotch was about $2.50 for a quart. I used to drink Chivas Regal. No taxes. So, alcoholic's paradise. I drank, and I continued to drink until I passed out or blacked out. That's also when I found out that if you have a soda machine, back then you had a soda machine where you pulled the bottle out. You know, and they had different flavors. Fanta had different flavors, and one of them was strawberry. And if you remember back in the 70s, now I don't know how many people here from the 70s and drank in the 70s, but there used to be a wine that was called Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill. Okay? So my buddy and I devised this idea because they kept, you know, we were honest Marines. We kept our cases of soda right there next to the machine, and when it got empty, somebody filled it up. When we took all the cases of Boone's Farm strawberry soda home, and we dumped them out and we filled them up with Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill. We were the only ones that drank strawberry soda. But I'll tell you, it made the afternoons go a lot easier. A lot easier. And nobody ever figured that out. Nobody ever figured that out. They couldn't, you know. But that was because I was able to maintain, because after we got done at work at 4:30, I became a member of the After Five Bunch. The After Five Bunch goes back to the barracks, changes clothes, and they meet at the club after five. Usually we were there at 5, knocking on the door. We didn't bother to go home and change, and we started drinking, and we closed the bar up. Well, again, I was approached about you're being late, you're getting drunk, you're getting into trouble. Get a job. What the heck can I do here on Okinawa? You can bartend. You don't drink when you bartend. I'm a good Marine. I don't drink while I bartend. I drink like a dog before. And then I go bartend, and then they buy me drinks. Of course, everybody buys a bartender drinks. And I'd save those drinks up until the time I got off, and I'd start drinking again. Well, on Okinawa, Japan, they have what they call benjo ditches. Now, a benjo ditch is where all the waste and sewage goes out from the little villages out into the ocean. They're open little trenches. They're about a foot wide, foot and a half wide. And I was walking home one night, and there was a benjo ditch there, and I jumped. And I slipped, and I fell back. And I remember looking at the moon and wondering whether I should get up or just stay there. And a bunch of my buddies came by and rescued me. They dragged my butt out of there and threw me in the shower and left me in the shower overnight because I stunk a little bit. But that's where my drinking takes me. You know. Now, it's all been kind of funny. And it's, you know, I haven't caused anybody any problems. The Marine Corps, well, they lost a little bit of money because I was doing a little bit of stuff with Howard Perry. I'll tell you about him later. Selling stuff to the black market. Because over there, meat is high volume. And if you have cigarettes, American cigarettes, you can sell them on the black market. And all that good stuff. So, that was that train of thought. Anyways, so it wasn't really creating any problems for anybody because I was sending money home and taking care of my wife at the time. And so I came home from Okinawa, and it's 1973 now. And picked up my wife in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I'm driving her back to California with me. And somewhere along Milwaukee and Kansas City and San Diego, she got pregnant. Because 9 months later, my daughter was born. And but, you know, I wanted to have my daughter to have everything that I didn't have growing up. And so I went to work again doing the one thing that I know how to do besides being a Marine, and that was a bartender. And so I went to work as a bartender. But this is where my drinking starts to take a different turn. Because all of a sudden, my drinking is getting to a point where I'm starting to drink while I'm working, first of all, which I hadn't done before. Then I started flirting with the women. And then the third step, of course, I started having affairs. And this is during the time that my wife was pregnant with my daughter. Now, my parents didn't raise me to do that. My father never said, it's okay for you to run around on your wife just as long as you produce and provide for her. You know? Because this is the man who, at 84 years of age, before when he passed away, his wife passed away when he was 50. When he was sober for a while, I asked him if he had a girlfriend. He said, I only had one girlfriend in my life, and that was your mom. Never had anybody else. So, you know, I wasn't raised to do that. My mom wasn't a woman that was that drank or smoked or went out. Well, she did smoke a little bit, but, you know. So I wasn't raised with those morals. But I was out there doing it, you know. Under the guise of, I'm helping raise money for my daughter. It's like, yeah, okay. And I started drinking and blacking out more. I started arguing with my wife more, you know. I needed to get out of that duty, so I volunteered for recruiting duty. Actually, I got volunteered. But I got volunteered for recruiting duty because I found out that you can drink and you can party all you wanted to. You know? And I wanted to go to drill instructor in school first, though. And they wouldn't let me because they were afraid I was going to hurt somebody. Me! You know? I just wanted to return the favor, but they wouldn't let me. So, you know, God's going to kick in here, and we're going to talk about program in a minute. I went to recruiting duty. I started doing my drinking again, and this time I wasn't getting DUIs. I got a DUI just before I went to recruiting duty, and they let me go because I was graduating within a week, and they said, "All right, fine, just go." And so I did. But in Wisconsin, I was drinking all the time. I was drinking like a fish, and I was blacking out, and I was passing out, and I was driving a government vehicle. You know, never hit anybody. You know, but I'm sitting there, and I get pulled over by the police. And 80% of the police in Wisconsin are either retired Army, retired Marines, or some type of military force. And so they'd see me. I'd be in uniform 90% of the time. They go, "Come on, get in the car." And their partner would drive my car and follow us home. Never got a ticket. But that, after drinking and, you know, just getting into so much problems, but enjoying myself during that time, I asked my wife for a divorce, and I asked her for a divorce because I was tired of having to come home. I was tired of having my daughter wake me up on Saturday morning because she wanted to play. I had plans, and it didn't involve them. That's where my drinking takes me, okay? And so I'm sitting there, I'll give you an example of what happened one time. I was laying on the couch. I was recuperating from a hangover. It's a Saturday morning. Now, when my daughter was first born, I was able to curtail my drinking to the point where on Saturday mornings, I'd wake up and I'd put her on my chest and I'd turn her head towards the TV and we both watched cartoons. You know, that was my introduction of her to the cartoons. I wanted to watch cartoons, but I couldn't say that. I wanted her to watch the cartoons. So we'd watch cartoons, and, you know, we'd spend a good morning together with her just laying on my chest. It was good bonding time. So here it is, a year and a half later, almost 2 years later, I'm laying on the couch suffering with a hangover, and my daughter comes over, and she's, you know, "Are you awake?" You know, that type of thing. You know, and I'd push her. I'd say, "You know, go play with your mom." You know, go. And she'd leave for a little while, and then she'd come back. You know, and Just go away. And she, "I want to play." I said, "No, just go play with your mom." You know, finally, it got to the point where I just yelled at her and told her to go away. And she runs crying into the kitchen. And I hear my wife in a very painful voice, I can still recall that, saying, "All she wants to do is play with you. She loves you." It didn't faze me. I was hurting. I wanted to recover from my drunkenness. I wanted to get this hangover over with. And the only way I knew how to do that was to drink. And so I'd get up, I'd get dressed. I wouldn't even shower. I'd get dressed. And I'd get angry because she gave me the perfect reason for me to jump up and get the heck out of there. Because, damn it, you can't let me rest. So the hell with you. I'm going to work. I never went to work. I went to the bar in the corner. Milwaukee's got a bar in every corner. I went to the bar in the corner. And I drank. And so I got divorced. Okay, I got divorced, and you know my drinking continued. I ended up getting transferred to the Upper Peninsula, where they frown on people taking a swing at their highway patrolmen. And I did that, and what ended up happening, that had to be God's intervention, because by this time I hadn't gotten any tickets, but I'd driven my car off the road. And the Upper Peninsula is like really bad in wintertime. I was driving 60 miles an hour, middle of the night, hit some ice. My car goes flying off the road. It catches a little signpost by the bottom, and apparently just flips the car around into a snowbank, facing out. Nobody called the police. They just said, "We'll get the tractor out. Wait a minute." And they pulled me out, and I went home. You know, but that's where my drinking is taking me. I'm blacking out. I don't know what the heck I'm doing on the road. I get thrown in jail, and on Monday morning, my sergeant major is standing there, and you know, I'm in my uniform, of course, and the judge says, 90 days in jail. You go in jail for 90 days, nobody swings at our police officers, and you need to pay for his damage to his uniform. Damage his uniform, and he just wanted to get it cleaned, but I got to pay for that, too. So, I'm just taking it, okay. And my sergeant major stands up and he says, "This is an excellent Marine. You know, he's an outstanding performer. He's got a problem. We realize he's got a problem. We want to send him to treatment. If you let him go to treatment instead of going to jail, the government would be indebted to you." And so the judge agreed. He said 90 days in jail if you fail treatment. You know, so we're going to let you go to treatment. But if you fail treatment, you're coming right back here. And you're going to jail and you're going to lose your military career. Because if you go to jail for any more than 30 days, you're done. So I said, okay. He said, but he says, if you fail treatment, you're coming right back here. Okay? He says, but if you complete treatment, stay out of the state of Michigan. You know, we don't want you here. And I haven't been back to the state of Michigan yet. So, but I went through treatment, and I did with treatment like I did any other military school. You know, I went in there, I went in to succeed, I did what they asked me to do, and I went beyond that. You know, and so I was an exemplary patient. You know, I knew the steps. I knew the big book. You know, I knew the 12 and 12. They had some young man who was a Spanish speaker come in, and nobody could talk to him because he was a Spanish speaker. So they said, Raul, would you talk to this young man? So I talked to him, and I talked to him for a couple of hours, and sharing my experience, strength, and hope with him. You know, and he realized that he was an alcoholic, and he volunteered to go to treatment, and they sent him to Florida, where apparently they had Spanish-speaking counselors. But what ended up happening is, you know, and hear this clearly, don't feed my ego anything. It's big enough already. So I'm sitting there, I'm already feeling good about myself. And so at graduation from treatment, before graduation, I was told by two or three counselors that, hey, you know, you could really do a good job as a counselor. You know, and it's like, yeah, I could. I got out of treatment, and a week later, I was drunk, you know, and because I went back to my family of origin, I went to my sister's house, because that's where all Marines go when they don't have a place to go. They go to their sister's house or their mother's house, but I went to my sister's house, and my sister, God love her, she's a good Mexican woman, excuse me. It is the belief in the Mexican culture that men have the right to do as they choose with their life. Women are not supposed to interfere. That's the attitude I was raised with. In my family, my sisters were raised with that attitude also. So when my sister was sitting there with me at the table at her friend's house, and her friend offered me a drink of wine, and I said yes, she looked at my sister, and my sister looked at her, she looked at me, and she looked back at her friend, and she said, he's a grown man. He can make his own decisions. And I started drinking again. And before the night was out, I was in blackout. I was driving somebody's car. I think it was mine. And that's the way I stayed until I had to report to Camp Pendleton. Now, I'm in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I stayed drunk. I drove this little 240Z cross country. You know, drunk all the way into Mexico, where I met family who owned a liquor store, who gave me a bottle of tequila and a bottle of rum and to help me across my long desert trip. And I reported out to Camp Pendleton drunk. Actually, I didn't the first night because I showed up, I was grungy, and you know, the troop wouldn't let me into the gate. They brought me into the gatehouse, and the lieutenant on duty said, Staff Sergeant, you need to get yourself a hotel room. Sleep this off. Get into uniform and report properly. Aye, aye, sir. So I went back, got myself a hotel room, did what I was supposed to do, reported the next day, and everything was good. Now, that was 1979 when I went to treatment. It was from 1979 till 1981 that I was in and out of AA because either I had a wife, a girlfriend, or a fiance, or all three that wanted me to go to AA, or I had the Marine Corps that was standing over me wanting me to go with AA. But during those 2 years that I was in and out of this program, the only thing I did right was I kept on coming back, regardless of what my reason was. You know? And the Marine Corps kept on saying, this guy doesn't have a problem. He can stop drinking. And I could. I was sober for 30 days, 60 days. I was sober for 90 days. I was sober up to 6 months. And convinced every one of those officers that I didn't have a drinking problem. Because I could stay sober as long as I was with you guys. And that was the one thing that made it through all that mess, is that if I was in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't get drunk. You know, and if I didn't drink, I wouldn't black out. I wouldn't pass out. I wouldn't get DUIs with 0.33 blood alcohol content. You know, I wouldn't get thrown in a drunk tank for drunk in public. None of that stuff happened. You know? And the Marine Corps believed that so much that they sent me to 5 substance abuse workshops just to make sure that, you know, I wasn't really an alcoholic. And then they sent me to Okinawa, Japan in 1981. And I requested to go there because I'd gotten another DUI one more time. And they were already threatening to kick me out. The rumors were already there. So I went to Okinawa, Japan, and that was in May, Memorial Day weekend of 1981. And from that weekend until June the 5th, I drank. And I'll tell you, I got to Okinawa, Japan, and this is what I'd never wanted to become this. You know, I'm a United States Marine. I'm a gunnery sergeant Marine by this time. And in the Marine Corps, if you're the gunny, you're the go-to guy. Everybody goes to the gunny for the answer. Everybody. Navy has their chief, their E7, same thing. You got a problem, you go to the chief. Well, in the Marine Corps, it's the gunny. So I knew nothing about my job anymore. I got to Okinawa, Japan. I wore my plastic raincoat. If you guys that are here, ladies that are here, were in the Marine Corps at that time, you remember we had plastic raincoats. Okay? And that plastic raincoat just fit. Yeah, I was so big, I was bloated from all my drinking. You know, and here I am on Okinawa, Japan. There's a few Marines out there that know what I'm talking about. It's hotter than all hell. Okay, Memorial Day weekend, it's hotter than all hell. It's humid. And I'm wearing, at that time, you had to wear your Charlie uniform, which is your dress uniform, not Charlie, your Alpha uniform, which is your full dress uniform. And I had my raincoat on top. It wasn't raining. You know? And they told me, Gunny, you can take the raincoat off. I go, I can't. Don't want to. It's okay. You know? I was afraid that they would see that I couldn't button my jacket of my uniform coat. That's what I was afraid of. It wasn't that it was raining outside. You know? It wasn't that I had this air conditioner going on inside of my body. I just didn't want anybody to see how grotesque I looked in my uniform. You know? And when I finally got checked in and I checked into my work section, they said, all you have to do is answer the phone and write down whatever the message is. That's it. And I thought I'd arrived. I thought I'd arrived because isn't that the epitome of being in control and being in charge? All you have to do is answer the phone and take notes. It isn't. You know? So what ended up happening is I came to work, and all of a sudden here's this young lieutenant and here's this young corporal, and they're looking at me like, you know, they're just disgusted. Just disgusted. And I looked at them, and that was my bottom. I can't tell you why my daughter crying after I hurt her wasn't my bottom. I can't tell you why my ex-wife crying after I divorced her wasn't my bottom. I can't tell you why being picked up with a .33 blood alcohol content wasn't my bottom. Or damn near running off the road with my Camaro wasn't my bottom. But this was. I saw that disgusted look one more time, and it was like, I want to get it out of my system. And so I went back to my, I went to the club first and tried to drink, and I couldn't get drunk. And so I left the club and went back to my room, and I started drinking my scotch out of the bottle, like it was water, and it wasn't working. And for the first time in my life, I was left with the one thing that I was running away from, and that was me. And the alcohol stopped working. Then all of a sudden, I made the connection. You know, I wouldn't have cheated on my wife if I hadn't been drinking. I wouldn't have hurt my daughter if I hadn't been drinking. You know, I wouldn't have disgraced the uniform if I hadn't been drinking. You know, I wouldn't have disgraced my family if I hadn't been drinking. You know, every time I looked at an incident in my life, I was either drinking, drunk, or suffering from a hangover and doing whatever the hell I could to get to that drink so I wouldn't have to suffer. You know? And so I said the only prayer that an alcoholic knows how to say, and that was, God, please help. And I can't tell you if I passed out, blacked out, or if I went to sleep, but I woke up the next morning with the moment of clarity that said, either you go back to Alcoholics Anonymous and try this one more time, or you continue doing what you're doing and you'll die drunk. And so when I got to work that morning, I called AA, and actually it was the Alcohol Rehab Center on Okinawa, And they said, there's a meeting right here tonight, just a speaker's meeting. We have somebody there at your camp that will give you a ride to the meeting and back. I said, okay, thanks. And they gave me the phone number and the name of the gal. And I made believe that I was writing it down because I had to convince myself that I was writing it down when I wasn't. Because if anybody was going to go and take me back to AA, it was going to be me. See? That is the ego of the alcoholic. You know? I'm down in the gutter. I'm getting ready to get kicked out of the Marine Corps. And I don't want this person to drive me to AA because if I'm going back to AA, damn it, I'm going to take myself back. And I'm like, oh, yeah. So I get on a bus and I get lost. And I ended up paying something like $20, $30 to a cabbie to get me to this meeting on time. But I got to the meeting on time. And that was the beginning of my tour, my time in recovery. So that was June the 5th, 1981. And that's where I met Howard Perry. And that's where I met a few of the other people that helped me learn what it is to be a recovering alcoholic. Because, and it was said, I'm sure it was said, but I never heard it, that if I come to meetings only, I'm going to get drunk. Because AA and the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous is not about just coming to meetings. It's about becoming a part of, you know, and that's why the first word and the first step is we and not I, you know. And Howard took me, you know, he said, this is what you're going to do. And I said, well, why? He said, well, you've already done the first three steps. So I want you to do a fourth step. And I want you to do it between now and 2 weeks. And if you do it, that's fine. We'll continue to be your sponsor. If you don't do it, get yourself somebody else. And that's the type of person I needed to be my sponsor. He as well as the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, my ego needed to be smashed. And he did that. You know? And he told me, he says, when you go to work, because I was working in a warehouse, he says, when you go to work, take your jacket off. The jacket is where we have our rank insignia. I said, why? He goes, because I want you to talk to people. I don't want you to talk at them. He says, I want you to be a part of that working community that you lead. I don't need anybody. I have this corporal and this lieutenant. He goes, I don't care. Take the jacket off. And so I did. You know, because at that point, I became more afraid of going back out and drinking than finding out about who Raul was. You know, and I'll be forever grateful for Howard. You know, and some of you know this already, but the reason why I picked Howard to be my sponsor is because Howard and I used to steal from the Marine Corps and sell it out on the black market. And so I told Howard, if you tell anybody anything that I tell you, I'm going to turn you in. Yeah. 2 weeks to a month later, Howard spoke and he told everybody everything that he'd done. So I didn't have a damn thing on him. So that's how my journey began in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, one thing that Howard instilled in me was that I had to go to meetings. And so the only thing that I've done right in the 26 years I've had in this program is that I've kept on coming back. And I've kept on sharing. Those of you that know me from meetings know that I'll go in there and I'll tell you exactly what the hell's going on with me. Because as long as it stays in my head, it's going to drive me crazy. And as long as it stays in my head, it becomes real. And the more real it becomes, you guys don't matter anymore. Because all of a sudden, I'm right, and you're wrong, and it doesn't matter what you say. You know, I've come to learn in the short time that I've had in this program is that God speaks to me through you. Regardless of whether I want to hear what you have to say or not, He speaks to me through you. Okay? And so I come to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I see this young man sharing about his baby dying at birth. You know, and him talking about being there for his wife during that delivery and after that, but him needing to be at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because he needed to be safe. And that's where I learned that this was a safe place to share whatever the heck you have to share. This was also a safe place to cry. And men role modeled for me that it was okay to cry in these meetings. Where I come from, it's not okay to cry. It's not. You know, I retired in 19th from the Marine Corps after 24 years of active duty as a Master Gunnery Sergeant. And I had 14 years of recovery at that time. Okay. My daughter gave birth to my grandson in 1996. Right? I have to ask my wife. Anyways, We weren't married at the time. But my daughter calls me up and she says, "Dad, I have some news for you." I said, "Okay, what?" She goes, "I'm pregnant." I said, "How the hell did that happen?" That's what she did. She goes, "Don't you know?" I said, no. I said, no. I said, "This is not a time to be joking." And she goes, "Dad." I said, "No." And, you know, we got into this argument. And, you know, we ended up just saying goodbye. And so I sat there and I felt bad about that conversation. And so I talked to my sponsor and I prayed about it. And I called my daughter up the next day. And I said, "Honey, I was hurt and I was afraid. I'm afraid for you. I know what your mom went through as a single parent. You know, I'm afraid that you're going to have the same life. And I don't want that for you. You know, I'm here for you if you need me. If you need financial help, I'll help you. I'll do whatever I can. But I want you to know that I'm here and I love you." And we both started to cry, of course. And I talked to my daughter a couple years later. And I said, "You know, I'd have done that when I was on active duty in recovery." She goes, "Nuh-uh. Nuh-uh." It was something about taking off the uniform and transitioning into civilian life that allowed me to become able to feel a little bit more and be able to make myself a little bit more vulnerable. You know, and that's part of the military life, you know, because I needed to protect myself from whatever was going on out here so it wouldn't affect me and I had to make the decisions that I had to make. Okay, once I left that, I didn't need to do that anymore. I'm almost getting to time. So my daughter and I have a great relationship. She just gave birth to my granddaughter in September 7th. And so we're going to go see her next month. My grandson and I, he's 12 years old, have a great relationship. You know, my son-in-law and I have a great relationship. The father that I almost had a hate-love relationship with died after 15 years of recovery. And during that 15 years, we were able to repair our relationship. We didn't have to hug and tell each other, you know, we loved each other or about what we did, because we knew what we did. You know, we knew we were both alcoholics. And so just the ability to sit in the same room and touch hands or give them a hug was basically the amends that we needed to make to each other. You know, and in 1994, when I retired from the Marine Corps, my father came out and saw me. And my aunt, who had been raising me since I joined the Marine Corps in 1970, told him, "He's my son now. He's going to stay here in California, so you need to relinquish your rights to him." So he said, "Okay, he's your son." You know, because she had been my mom since 1970 after my mother passed away in 1969. You know, and let's take a step back. When my father passed away, I was able to go home for the funeral and be there with him when he passed away. But the privilege to that was being able to bring his ashes back and take him back to Mexico where he wanted to go to after he passed away and spread his ashes in the mountains in the Sierra Madres. You know, just 3 weeks ago, September the 12th, at 12:13 p.m., my aunt passed away. And she was a very important part of my life. My uncle needed to go take care of business. And my cousins, for whatever reason, couldn't accompany him to buy the plot and make the funeral arrangements. And he looked at me, he goes, "You're my son, come on, let's go." And so I went with my uncle and I was able to be there with him and for him. But before I left, I went over and gave my aunt a hug and a kiss, and I told her I'd be back in a little bit. And she passed away while I was gone with my uncle. So it's been a hell of a journey. You know, there's been other tragedies in my life that have happened, you know, but it's life. It's what happens. We get old and we pass away. You know, people go back out and drink and they die. You know, I went back out several times and people wondered whether I was going to make it back or not. You know, I have seen men, Jerry Mahoney, Jim Baum, Chuck Courtney, all men that participated in meetings that I went to, face death and did it sober. And that's the way they passed away. Because they knew that dying sober was the only way to go. Drinking was not going to help anything. So if you're sitting here for the first time and you're having doubts as to whether you're an alcoholic, let me tell you that people don't come to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting because things are going great in their life. Okay? They don't. The other thing is that if you're wondering if you're an alcoholic or not, people do not wonder whether they're alcoholics or not. They don't. You know, we all had that doubt when we were drinking. I did, you know. But the bottom line is that, you know, the miracle happened to me when it needed to happen, and that was on Okinawa on June the 5th of 1981. And it's going to happen for you when it's supposed to happen for you. The only thing that I ask you to do is the same thing that this lady asked me to do in 1979 at a speaker's meeting in Vista. She says, honey, all you got to do is you got to keep coming back. That's all. You just got to keep coming back. So just keep coming back. You know, it'll happen when it's supposed to happen. You know, and if you're having struggles, just imagine how great of a story you're going to have to tell when you get your ass up here. I had to do it one time. You know? My wife told me before I came up here, don't curse. You know? So I believe that's about all my time. Okay. So, you know, that brings me to tonight. You know, I just started a scary prospect. I've gone into business for myself in private practice. I left a job that was a great job, great pay. But let's just say our ethics were different. And so I decided to leave because I wasn't willing to give up my ethics for money or a position. And that's a hell of a change for an alcoholic that blew a .33 at one time, because I was willing to give up the baby at that point. You know? And so, you know, I don't know. I don't know what else I can tell you other than God graced me, you know, when he allowed me to beat myself into submission one more time. Brought me to the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous into the fold, you know, of your arm, loving arms. And you guys taught me how to live life as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for that, I will forever be grateful. Thank you very much.